At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try a new food and suddenly it's like, okay, hold on, I got a new favorite food.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie Mayo.
Yeah, it's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it at the grocery store.
And this mayo is different.
Mm-hmm. Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything. Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
Parallel Lives. Parallel Lives is a new book. It's a new book from established author Mariam Dina. It's tracing a fascinating story. About one of my favorite art people involved with one of my favorite art movements, which was the Bauhaus. Edith Tudor Hart was a Bauhaus trained photographer, and Ursula Kaczynski, a writer and polyglot. Both were immigrant dissidents fighting fascism through the turbulent 30s and 40s. It is the subject of a new book by Mariam Dina called Parallel Lives. I'm delighted to say that Mariam joins us live on the line now. Mariam, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jill. Thanks for inviting me.
The pleasure is all mine. Tell me a little bit about the background to writing Parallel Lives, this fascinating story during a really interesting period of history.
Yes, Jill, I'm very interested in writing about and researching about this interwar period. And my previous book also spoke about women artists in the surrealist movement also in this period. So I continued my research, and I was fascinated to see that this upheaval and, as you mentioned, this rise of fascism brought a huge amount of immigrants. So it was an exodus towards England specifically, and there was this Jack and Molly Pritchard who had this brilliant idea of building with this architect who's half Japanese, half Canadian, a new way of living, a new way of life. It's a statement. It's not just an architecture beauty, which is one of the first buildings in concrete, built in concrete for housing. It's the modernist building, which is in Hampstead. And there, you know, they all joined somehow. It was the intellectual circle. People came. So Ursula and Edith obviously were in contact with this whole intelligentsia of the left party. And Ursula and Edith, because she was, of course, interested and, as you said, a photographer from Bauhaus, she was commissioned to take photos of this building. So during the whole year of the construction from 33 to 34, she documented and she took these pictures. And she was quite involved also with this new way of life which was presented. I got really fascinated because somehow I found out that the stories that happened there between these women, these emigres, they must have something together, linked, you know. They must have they met, have they not met? What was this dynamic? And somehow I brought these personal histories to life. But, of course, their vicinity is just an act of imagination. I mean, you know, it's a novel, but it's based on these two characters. And I just was fascinated to explore about this, you know, woman who arrived in a new country, having known, of course, a little bit about, you know, they started to learn languages and they got adapted to a new life. And of course, in Isaacan, there were the Bauhaus masters who arrived already in 1935, you know, it was Gropius and Marcel Breuer, who did, by the way, most of the furniture, which is in the Isocon, and Maholi Nudge, the artist. They were all there, and also in between, of course, these lives of these women who are trying to survive, trying to find a way, but they're somehow what they wanted was to fight against the fascist regimes, and through their life and experience, because they have seen, you know, such misery after the First World War and unemployment and really malnutrition for children. So they were committed to the communist cause, because at the time this was the way to see a future with more positive and more right society.
It stood for, I mean, Bauhaus stood for everything that fascism wasn't. And when, of course, there's the famous degenerate art exhibition that happens in Berlin in the late 30s, supposedly to show how awful expressionism is. So you've got, you know, the Max [S2] Yes. [S1] Ernst exhibitions, and then you've got Ernst pieces up there. You're looking at Bauhaus [S2] Yes. [S1] Pieces. It's, you know, the Dada movement. Those are loudly mocked by people like Goebbels and Hitler himself. And then they have this awful exhibition of what they called Aryan arts, you know, which is classical forms, but just awfully done.
Yes.
So there were, I mean, people who fled from the Bauhaus, because a lot of people stayed as well, but it didn't end well for them, did it? So Bauhaus was absolutely against everything it stood for.
Yes, absolutely. And this is why they all left, you know. And of course, they didn't want to. I mean, even there were, you know, Gropius who insisted for Marcel Breuer to leave, because he said, this is very dangerous. We can't continue working in our free thinking and free-spirited life anymore. And you need to come to a country where we will have new possibilities, where there's not this upheaval of, you know, political, you know, sort of complicated situation, which will bring us all to a point where there's nothing left really to do. So Marcel Breuer was convinced to come, and of course he came to meet Gropius there, and he was, of course, he was commissioned to do the furniture, but he was really looking for making more architecture projects, and of course they were searching for architecture projects. At the time, it was also quite difficult for them. Even Jack Pritchard got involved, and he was writing letters asking, wanting to integrate them in the scene of architecture in London. But it was difficult times also in London. So after a year and a half that they stayed, and they noticed that there's maybe not as much possibility as they wished, then Gropius immigrated to America. And then convinced Marcel Breuer to also join him, and this is how there was the next step of immigration, you know, happening for the Bauhaus masters.
Sure, and of course the Isocon is still standing. It's in Belsize Park, isn't it? And of course we now are used to seeing buildings like this, but this is early 1930s. So this is a really radical departure, and after you.
Yes, absolutely. And I just wanted to say that yesterday it was the 90th anniversary of it.
Yeah, so and as you said, there were...
It was a 90-year-old building, as you say, now we're used to see. But 90 years ago, in this little street of Hampstead, it was quite a vision, you know, these cantilevered balconies facing the lawn road. It looked like a huge boat, you know, overlooking this tiny street. And also, you know, as we said at the beginning, this philosophy of, you know, offering affordable flats. There were 34 flats affordable, so you could, you know, as a young professional woman could afford that. There were some services. There was a communal life. It offered really a new way of life, how the modernists had the vision before.
And that's something perhaps because it was a time, the interwar years, which are also fascinating because you have the rise of the far right and you have the rise of the far left, and they both have their visions, one considerably darker than the other. But everything links in this. So you have literature, you have art, you have architecture, you have political movements, and they all seem, you know, it's nothing exists in a vacuum, as the saying goes.
Exactly. And I mean, even the manifesto, you know, of the Siam, of the architecture, you know, meeting. And this is just a way to integrate architecture and give it a social art. You know, everything, as you said, was interconnected. You were not just building for the beauty of an architecture. It had a meaning. It had to offer something new: light, sky, sun, trees. Everything had a purpose for let's say, for improving the life for people. And I think that's the beauty of it. And maybe we don't pay attention anymore to this extraordinary philosophy of the modernists who really did what we now experience in life. It's all really thanks to this moment that all these energies gathered. And this is what was created.
So tell us a little bit about Edith Tudor Hart, because she's fascinating, isn't she?
Yes, she's quite an instant précoce. And she was was not working, but her father and uncle had this bookshop in Vienna. And so she was reading books, you know, at a very early age, quite a progressive bookshop. So she had access to all sorts of books that at this age, you know, young girls were not supposed to read. And so she was quite well informed about everything. And she just meets the man who changes her life one day in the bookshop, coming to get, you know, one of these interesting books that she knew already about. So this man was very interested, this young girl, you know, how does she know about, He was impressed. So Edith was really a very impressive person, and one could tell that she wanted to help, and to she was also quite interested in the in Montessori way of teaching children, and she even she was so good that she was then sent to England to make a special course and follow that and. So she was quite involved really in making the society better, but also helping children and their education. And but then again, she was also confronted with this misery that she saw on streets everywhere, you know, after the war. She was really heart-wrenched. And this is how she joined also the Youth Communist Party, and in order to be able to fight. You know, there's a way to fight against that and to help, and her way was the best way was with the camera. She had the power of words with her images. She was very quite concentrated in this social circle of the workers, the trade union. I mean, and she went out there and she took pictures of how real life is.
Yeah.
No one did, you know. This was so interesting, you see, for the first time about she worked for magazines and she wanted to show. She couldn't write about it because she was showing it with her images and how, she believed that that's the best way to inform people. And also, I mean, she continues, you know, the tradition of her family, because they also wanted to have this bookshop to inform and to educate, you know, people who are not in this privileged surrounding where they can get books and things. And so, you know, this family also, the secular Jewish family, very well educated. And I think their mission was to educate and make many things clear for people. And help them to see clear.
And also, the thing is, you see, The photographs she takes in Austria of the Montessori children in the field, you know, unemployed family in Vienna, which is quite a famous picture. It's a Degas. It's almost there's a sense of ballet in their movement, and yet there are the pictures that she takes in London or whatever, and they are quite, you know, they could be from Victorian era, couldn't they? Because they are showing social deprivation. So she's making a statement with that. And if you look at what happens in the 30s because in the end she ends up becoming recruiting sort of Anthony Blunt and the spy ring, but you have to understand, but you see the Spanish Civil War and that slide into the Second World War, and you can see why people who are ideological like her end up spying for the Soviet Union.
Yes, exactly. It was really for her belief. You know, she was not a financial. Of course, she always had financial problems, but it's not that she earned being this agent, and she truly believed. And Arnold Deutsch, who was the man who worked in the bookshop, was a person who really formed her also, played a huge role in her life. And I think this was her. It was a way she relied on him, you know, and her husband, we just mentioned about Spanish Civil War.
Yeah.
He was a surgeon and he joined the Civil War. She was quite upset about that. Of course, her fight also brings her to line with that, but she just had a child and she didn't want him to go. She didn't know how long this is going to take. So this is really, in this book, I liked to express the fact that these women, they had also the worries of us all women, you know, then we have children, then, you know, you don't want the father to be away, you have to deal with so many different levels of life. And this is why somehow they're connected to us, these extraordinary women, because they have the same. They have love, they care, they had, but on top of all that, they had this incredible courage, you know, to follow their commitment. So I wanted to bring into light this difficult position that they really had during the 30s and also 40s. Yes.
It's and also, of course, there. You know, it's about two. And we've only talked about one of the ladies there, but of course, we're also looking at Ursula Kuniecki, and I hope I'm saying that correctly. Who is a writer? Yes. And the thing, both these women never meet, but they are joined, if you like, by the building.
Yes, they're joined by the building, but also, Gilles, by their background somehow. I mean, of course, Ursula, she came from Berlin, but also from a very well-educated Jewish secular family. And also from, you know, they both have lots of siblings. They're connected to each other, all of them brilliant. And she also worked in bookshops. Her interest was also in reading books. Her father had the greatest, actually, private library in Berlin. You know, they had incredible social circles. They had Einstein and they had all sorts of, intellectuals who really, Mahler and musicians, artists who came into her life. So also she was exposed to quite a lot as a young person, and she was aware of what is going on. And then she marries this architect who was in Berlin, and they moved together to Shanghai, and because he had a project there. So somehow for her was a new life, also a new way of seeing things. But there she noticed that, again, how difficult it was, and she wanted to be involved and for a more just society. And she was quite bored by being just, you know, entertained by the on the foreigners. She needed to be part of something that's happening and help. And so, yeah, these women, you know, she learned Chinese and you know, they wanted to be part of what is happening in the world. Not only, of course, they have families and they are, you know, living in a different country. Of course, they have to adapt, but their courage took them so far. And in a way, it's really it encapsulates the essence of 20th century history in Europe. You know, it was the war, then it was the exile, and then the hope that they had, this commitment. You know, it all comes together in their lives in such a condensed way. And I was fascinated by that. And her father, I mean, Ursula's father, he was a very well-known also economist, and he was giving, he had a post at the London School of Economics, and they were extremely educated and knowledgeable, the entire family. And this exodus of the entire family, the sister of Ursula arrived. She was also living in the Isokon building. So somehow this Isokon played, I found in my research, such a important role in gathering these minds and these. So this energy was this dynamic of people fighting for the same cause, being somehow aligned, in their mind, whether they are writing or they're journalists or they're artists. It was really one movement.
And you can argue that it's a fascinating period because you have these women who are independent, bohemian, they're idealistic, they're creative, and then the Spanish Civil War and Second World War comes, and then during the sort of the 50s or the post-war, even though women have played significant roles in every aspect of the war, and then suddenly it's as if they are, women's movement is put back and it doesn't really get going again until the 60s, you can argue.
That's very true. That's very true. And somehow maybe also that's why, everything really got quiet with the life of Ursula and Edith. I mean, she started, she, of course, in the 50s, she escaped or moved to East Berlin and started to write. And it's true, there was, after that, there was a moment of, like you said, of a vacuum. Like, I think everyone just had a moment of, thinking about, what was next. I mean, it was really such a hard experience. And devastating, really. They believed, though, that they helped. You see, they believed, if Ursula was, giving these atomic secrets to Klaus Fuchs, she definitely believed that this was the way to save the world. So they felt that they did their part. But then, as she arrived in East Berlin, and then she saw what has really happened in the Soviet Union and and also how this East Berlin situation and the poverty there, she got very disillusioned by all that. And of course, she's not going to now regret everything she has done, but it was a moment of being, rethinking about, how much was it, how much of this history that happened. I mean, did she know or she didn't know? We don't know.
Yeah.
But of course, it is quite a moment of reflection to believe that I have done something right or I haven't after being so committed and living so dangerously.
It must be difficult. It must be difficult to put yourself in the minds of these two very different women, and still tie it to the building, because base the story around that, because it is a work where you're having to imagine what they're thinking, or even though these are real people in real places with real events.
Yes, I mean, some real events, are, of course, it's a novel, so some of the real events that I have found maybe are also integrated, but I started with discovering Edith's work, and I was very fascinated, and then I got into the building, because she was, of course, very involved with the building. I mean, she documented, and, they recently found 15,000 negatives of her, pictures, an archive in Salzburg in Austria. She was very, very involved. Of course, she was also involved with the wife of Jack Pritchard, with whom she was in Montessori and did this Montessori education. So she, in a way, although she didn't live there, but she was, you know, she was very connected to this building. And Ursula on the other side because of her family, her brother and her sister living there. And I think that a space can also inspire, you know, and can also give, like, this space. It gave really a new way of thinking, you know. And that's what they wanted. They were in search of that.
It's a fascinating book, and it's just, I mean, I'm just, as I said, it's lovely to speak to you because I love the Bauhaus and I love that sort of period of history. What do you hope that people will learn from your book, Parallel Lives?
Yeah, I think it's a very simple message to know that, you know, you can be committed to whatever you're committed, I mean, whether it's good or bad, but if you really put everything into that and you deal with it, then I think it's quite a huge satisfaction.
The book is called Parallel Lives by Mariam Dima, who we're speaking to today. Mariam, if people want to find out about you or about the book, do you have a website? Can people find you on the social media? Where's the best place to see to find more about you and the book?
Oh, such a good question. No social media.
Well, okay.
I think that for my kids and maybe just Googling my name and many things come. And
yeah,
my previous books, Exquisite Corpse, it's available also on Amazon. But I really don't have, unfortunately,
probably,
don't have...
Probably a good move. Yeah. Probably a good move, I think. But you can...
Yeah.
Well, you'll be able to. Well, you'll be able to order the book as well via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Parallel Lives. It's by Mariam Dima. Mariam, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you so much, Jill. Thank you for your wonderful interview. Thanks.
This is Steve Covino from Covino and Rich. Quick trivia, fellas. Every guy listening is a contestant. Answer honestly to yourself. You got a belly and a little chest, gassed by the afternoon, no drive left in the tank. You lack that confidence and mental edge. Those are classic signs that your testosterone's been sliding, and nothing drags it down faster than extra weight. So why not take matters into your own hands? Strip off the weight that tanks your testosterone with Byoma GLP-1 Booster. Every serving is packed with science-backed ingredients that crank up your natural GLP-1 production. Visit Byoma.health/GLP1 and use code CRSHOW for 15% off your first order.
This is Troy Millings from Earn Your Leisure. On Earn Your Leisure, we're all about smart money moves, and here's one most people skip. Car insurance renews on autopilot, the rates creep up, and nobody tells you. That's what Insurify fixes. In about 2 minutes, completely free, you can see rates from more than 120 top insurance companies. And if there's nothing better today, they keep watching and notify you when there's a better rate. So go to Insurify.com. That's Insurify.com. Insurify.com.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.